Queen Selyse went to the king's side. The Lord of Light sent Melisandre to guide you to your glory. Heed her, I beg you. R'hllor's holy flames do not lie. Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Founded in 2010 as Two Chimps and a Chump, we thought it best to rename and rebrand ourselves freshly just in time for the game to keep the same in the second edition. Tune in each week for your dose of strategy, discussion, jokes, and good old geek culture. A huge thank you goes out to GRRM for his amazing novels, FFG for this fantastic game, Card Game DB for getting us a start, and you, our loyal listeners, for sticking through thick and thin. Check us out on our website, Facebook, or Twitter, or email us at contact@whitebookpodcast.com and rate us on iTunes. This CC licensed music is Town Function by Spinners.
That's a good quote. Holy flames.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, in this case, I'm equating us with Melisandre. We have been sent to guide the listeners to glory.
Is that a pun on the name of this team? Are we Team Glory? Or are we Team Honor?
No, we're actually Team Honor.
Oh, okay.
We're actually leading people to the other episodes.
I thought we were bad when it was Team Left and Right trying to figure it out and remember, but we're even worse with the new naming scheme. So,
yeah. Well, the glory I meant anyway was, you know, the glory and adulation of the masses for winning a tournament. So that's what we're here to lead listeners to.
Yes, it is. And to lead you tonight, I'm Roy Rogers.
And I'm Will Lentz, as usual.
We got to that pretty smoothly, you know.
Yeah, it's almost like the less of us there are, the easier it is to stay on topic.
It is. Well, you know, we didn't have any of our co-hosts to gently or not gently tease with this, you know, opening, and there's no, like, Aaron to immediately jump in with whatever nonsense is on Aaron's mind. So, you know, very easy, straightforward.
Yeah. I mean, we could pick someone to tease if we needed to.
No, I'm too tired for that nonsense. I can't even think of jokes.
Well, I mean, I think you have pretty good reason to be tired at this point. So,
it's true. I'll forgive you. Well, thank you, Will. I appreciate that. That's your good Midwestern charm.
Yes, that's my one good deed for the day.
Yeah.
I'm still working on the scout badge for that, but I'll get there.
I was just in your state the other day, and I was impressed how big... Everything is very far apart in Missouri, which I kind of knew from the map, but was it as the lived experience, as we historians like to say, it was unpleasant, the drive from St. Louis to Columbia.
I have multiple comments on that, actually. The first one is, it's so terrible that you were in my state and didn't come see me. And then, I'm not used to hearing that everything's so big or far apart in Missouri. That's normally what I hear about, I don't know, Texas or California.
Right. Well, the reason I didn't come see you and Kristen is Springfield was like in the opposite direction of where we were going. And, right? Because it's like St. Louis is what you can't see. I was making hand motions. But anyway, I think if I'm understanding the geography of the state right, Springfield is south of Columbia, right?
Yes, south and a little west.
Right. So, and this institute at the University of Missouri flew me and some friends out to do the show, and they were paying for every aspect of the trip, so I wasn't able to just be like, hey, can we make a detour to Springfield? So that was said. But I thought, when it was described to me, that once you know, that it was like a half hour or maybe even an hour drive from St. Louis to Columbia.
Wow. Someone did a bad job describing that.
It was not, particularly because we were stuck in New York-level traffic for Whatever. It was bad.
Yeah. Missouri is one of those states where the relevant portions of it are spread out to the corners. Like, if you're looking at Missouri as a pseudo square here, or at least a trapezoid, listeners,
it's close enough.
You've got St. Louis in the far upper right, Kansas City in the far upper left, Columbia almost in the dead center, and then Springfield in the almost far lower left, and nothing worthwhile in the lower right, in case you're wondering. But still, it's as spread out as it can get in the state, pretty much.
Yeah, that's as I learned to my worn out traveler's sorrow.
Man, so here we go. We go straight from staying really on topic and on task to boring our listeners to tears with geography lessons on my home state.
That's the kind of quality content you get at the White Book Podcast.
Yeah. Roy just can't help teaching.
It's
you just
true.
Can't help it.
I can't. I'm doing it 5 days a week now, and it's I just can't turn it off. It just flows out of me. It's in my blood. Well, I guess kind of. It just flows out of me. Flows.
I think that's as great a time as any to flow to the next topic. So, we do have a little bit of FFG news today, which is nice to see. Actually, there's been quite a bit of news from FFG in general. Lately, it just hasn't been Game of Thrones related. But we've got an announcement of the store championship prizes, and they also lump in the world championship celebration here, and a little bit about the Battle of the Trident, which I am a little bit bummed out about in this and the last article that was kind of directed to the Battle of the Trident. They keep lumping information in about these different things, rather than giving them their own articles, which I think makes it too easy to lose the information or not realize there are separate events. Like our local store, I think, only realized that there was supposed to be this world championship celebration thing today. So that's awkward.
That is kind of awkward. Are you guys doing, are you going to Iowa, or are you doing something in Springfield?
Yeah, I'm going up to IO Worlds, so this is actually a little awkward for me. I like that there is this kind of local celebration at the same time, and this way for folks that can't go to Worlds to kind of get in on the alt art stuff. Like, I think it's a great idea. I'm just bummed that before I knew this was a thing, I had committed to going to this privately like player-run IO Worlds event that weekend, so I don't believe they'll have access to these promos, and I of course won't be in Springfield, so I may miss out anyway.
Sad. I have to figure out what places in my area are running these World's Championship events. One of the things that's not 100% clear to me from this article is whether or not you're supposed to run it as the store championship that weekend, or if you're supposed to just run it as a separate event. I guess you're supposed to run it as a separate event.
It's supposed to be separate. It's not very clear in this article, but the prior one that broke down the kind of designer pitches for the three different Battle of the Trident options, if you scroll down to the bottom of that, lumped in with that in a way that I feel is not as clearly related or at least communicated to casual readers or people that didn't click on the headline to read the article, they actually have the schedule and breakdown of how these three different events will be timed and broken out from each other. Which is just awkward. Like, yes, I admit they communicated it. It's there. People can find it. Thank you for taking one faltering step in the right direction, FFGOP. But it's not in a way that people know that it's there to find it and know, like, what they're getting into. It's not an announcement of, like, fall OP schedule or something like that that people can point to and find easily. So, mm-hmm. I don't know. Just me offering some tips in possibly more correctly titling articles.
Yeah, so the other thing that sort of initially stands out to me is I wonder if, like, top 32 is the right size for the base promo for store championships. Like, we had a very uneven store championship season in the Northeast. Like, some store championships were very small, you know, like 12 people, maybe like 15, 16, but others were like 40 people. So it would just suck for someone to come to a store championship and not walk away with anything. I wish FFG had been like a little bit more generous, like maybe top 48 for these, you know, the Serio and for the, what is it, summons? Yeah, summons for the Battle of the Trident. Just slightly more generous.
Yeah, and if the event was smaller than that, you know, the extras can pretty easily go to the, you know, top 8 or winner or whatever, depending on how many extra copies are available.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I would have been down with that as well.
It also gives stores and, like, metas an opportunity to, like, have a little bit extras, you know, for people who may not be able to make it to the store championship, but at a game night kit, you could give it away as an extra prize or something like that, you know?
Right.
But the art is sweet on all of this alt art stuff. Yeah, the Serio is awesome.
Yeah, I'm really pretty happy with this, actually. I think it's good. You also get a teaser of the Winds of Winter for the World Championship weekend.
Mm-hmm. Which looks that awesome. Rubar,
yeah. That Rubar Royce looks pretty decent. The plaque's okay. I'm kind of curious to see how its quality is in person, but it looks good in the picture.
And it's good that they pick Serio, because Serio is definitely a card that you want a lot of, right? Until he rotates out. So, yeah. You know, most of your competitive decks are going to, maybe not, well, maybe, but it's still...
He's a competitor for a slot.
Yeah, for a slot. And if you're the kind of player like me who likes to have 3 to 5 decks built at any one time, it's nice.
Yes, definitely. And then, did you notice as well, there's a couple acrylic Tiers of List tokens?
Yeah, what do you think of that, Will?
It's interesting. I'm kind of... Like, I'm confused, I think, by scale. I'm just kind of wondering, because they're, in the art here, the preview picture we see, they're nearly half the size of a card, it looks like. So I'm kind of curious just about them being acrylic and, you know, how good the art's going to appear on there, how well it's going to stay, or if it's going to chip off. Plus, I got to wonder... Were these artwork-based tokens, I don't know, inspired by the White Book tokens?
They could be. I wish it was slightly better art, to be, like, can be completely honest. I don't particularly like the base Tiers of List art, so...
Okay. I think it's fine, I suppose. I would definitely prefer if the tokens had text on them to mm-hmm. say what they are.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah, I also am a little, like... I'm looking forward to when I unpack one of these store championship kits to see what those tokens look like, because I'm skeptical based on the totally realistic images that they have in this spread here.
Totally realistic.
Totally realistic. To scale, totally not just slapped on computer with Photoshop.
Yeah, no, not at all.
No. But the matte art is awesome for both of them, too.
Yeah, it looks pretty sick. I am pumped about that Battle for the Trident, or sorry, of the Trident. Like, that is artwork I've been itching to see on something like this.
Mm-hmm. So, I definitely, in many ways, I think, probably, I mean, the Robor Royce mat is nice, the art is really good, but of course it's a Robor Rice, Robor Royce, there we go.
Robot Rice.
Robot Rice, yes, thank you, Will. Matt, but that Red Keep art, like, that's going to be the kind of thing, you're going to be able to sell this, even though it'll be pretty common, because all the store championship, you know, kits will have one, but it's only one. Right. So, yeah, this is a sweet mat.
It's one, if I don't win it here locally, that I would be tempted to buy.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's accurate here, I actually even more like that it doesn't say a year or event or anything. Like, just the logo and the art kind of speak for themselves.
But what's up with these stars and symbols that they've started putting on all of the, like, alt art stuff?
Yeah, they seem to be, like, numbering the promos now, I guess, to help collectors track them down. You know, classic collector numbers, like, used to matter in the CCG version of the game, mattered considerably less so in the LCG. But I'm really surprised to see that on a mat. You think it really has it on the mat?
I don't know. They probably just pasted the art from the alt art. Well, I guess that's not even alt art, right, for the Red Keep. That's just the Red Keep art, the full bleed, yeah. Right? Because they are... This was a piece they broke into multiple things in first edition, right? Because isn't...
No, I don't think this was used in first.
Was it not used in first?
Second only.
Okay.
Yeah, because
there's Rainy's
sure.
Hill up there, right, and stuff. So
yeah, and the Sept over in the corner, I think, is, or no, the Dragon
Pit. Dragon Pit, yeah, corner.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I think this was the preview banner that they had hanging up at the event center when they kind of announced the fact that Second Edition existed.
So it's the OG Second Edition art.
Yeah, pretty much. Actually, makes me kind of surprised that this is the first we've seen it as a playmat or something.
Yeah. So, I mean, overall, I would probably say that this is a better store championship kit than last year's. Yeah. I mean, I liked the Tyrell mat, but I think, and the Tyrell box, but I think... anything is better than the Eerie. Like, they totally blew it with the Eerie, which wasn't even legal for, like, what, the entire store championship season?
Yeah, I think so.
So, I think this is a much better, well-thought-out kit. So, if I was rating, I'd say this is, like, a B+, A- kit from FFG. So, it definitely shows that they put a little bit more thought into what their store championship kits are going to be.
Which is good, I think. It means that we're seeing a gradual improvement in their attentiveness to organized play, I hope, right?
Mm-hmm. This is definitely a better sign. Like, if you are looking for signs of actual improvement, this is definitely one of them.
All right. I dig it. Any parting thoughts on... the prizes or special events that we have coming up?
I'm much more excited for the Battle of the Trident than I was before, after now seeing the prizes, so.
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad that there's going to be official events running for, you know, essentially like a 3-month span here pretty steadily. I think having that regularly happening is going to be key to keeping everyone's interest up and pulling in new players to come play competitively. So, yeah, I'm pumped.
Transition.
Woo! Right at the minute mark, too. Dang, that's good.
All right.
All right. So, dear listeners, we're back with another opportunity for Roy to stretch his teaching muscles. It is coming up to time not only to start prepping and thinking about what you're going to play for World Championship celebrations and tourneys for the Trident and Store Championships, but this little event coming up in just under a month. That is World Championship weekend at the FFG Event Center, and probably some down the road at the Overflow section.
So this year, there's going to be a ton of shit at the Overflow section, right? This is the last year that the whole smorgasbord is there, right? So,
yeah.
Worlds is going to be overcrowded this year, and Thrones has done, like, lickety-split, so...
So, again, I'm going to say to listeners, get in contact with Kyle Vansel and see if you can make it to Isle Worlds for Saturday and keep up the Thrones shenanigans. We will definitely be having some cool prizes for that. And, you know, we'll just try to make it the real World Championships.
Woo, go Kyle.
Yeah, I figured I'd pause there for a minute so all the listeners could kind of shake their fists at me, particularly the international listeners. But as far as I know, you're welcome as well. So if you were in the States, come check out Iowa. This will literally be the only reason to go to Iowa in your life.
Yeah, if you're European, you should definitely spend the thousands of dollars that it takes to get to North America and go to Iowa. That's a thing you should do.
Yeah. I mean, especially if you're, I don't know, a corn fan.
Open space fan.
Yeah. Wide open spaces. All right.
What's the opposite of claustrophobia? Because that's what I get when I'm in Iowa.
Oh, shoot. You know, I should definitely know that. Fear of open spaces, Google tells me, is agoraphobia. See,
agoraphobia. Yeah, I should have known that too. College education failing me yet again.
Yeah, wow. What did I go for 5 years for? Hint, nothing practical.
You were an English major, right?
Yes, with a history minor.
Ah, history. Man over after my own heart.
Yeah, does not get much more impractical than that combination.
Oh, well, I'm going to just close. I have so many opinions about that, but we will segue away from a long rant about educational policy and our attitude towards education and talk about preparing for a Major Thrones tournament, which is a different kind of education. Woo!
It is. I mean, that's something that we were.
Yeah, that was what we were going to do.
I think this was initially your idea, according to the email chain. Am I remembering that right, Roy?
It was probably something I suggested in a moment of inspiration. Because I remember the first time that I went to sort of a larger tournament, a regional or Gen Con or Worlds. Like, I was just incredibly nervous and not quite sure what to do. And I was lucky enough that I had, you know, come from a pretty big meta and there were people there to mentor me and sort of help me get through it. But for people who are sort of maybe a little bit more isolated or are in a newer meta that hasn't really done one of these bigger events like Gen Con in the summer or Worlds upcoming or a big, you know, something like Iowa Worlds or Red Saturday. You know, we are, of course, also coming to the Store Championship season. So I was thinking, like, what will... Because you have been playing since the CCG era. What's, like, the first thing you do before you... Or, right, what's the first thing you do when you want to prepare for a big tournament?
I would say the first thing I do is probably try to decide what deck I feel about 75% likely that I want to play. Most of the time, I would say that's something that I've been playing, you know, off and on at our game nights for a few weeks. But every once in a while, it may be something that I've heard or seen online, or seen a metamate, Greg, playing, and I'm like, oh, hey, that looks really interesting. I'm gonna try to put together a version of that. But I don't always have something that I have picked 100%. So I would say right in that 75-ish range, something that I feel comfortable enough going into actual kind of testing and some crunch rounds as we put things through their paces. How about yourself?
Absolutely. Actually, for me, the advice that I would give is related to that, but I would definitely, particularly if it's your first event, I would go with a deck that you are really comfortable with, that you have put the testing into, not necessarily the testing and you know, you've played it, you know, the testing, like rigorous scientific form of testing, but sort of you've put the reps in, even if that rep is just against, you know, your best friend. Because at the end of the day, with these big tournaments, particularly if it's your first time, you're going to really need that muscle memory that you develop by playing a deck over and over and over again. And my experience with big tournaments is actually I have done best when I am playing a deck that I just have lots of reps, even if it's not the most obvious meta call, even if it's not the kind of deck that we talk about here as sort of the best deck, or they talk about on Beyond the Wall or whatever podcast or article you read. But particularly when you're just starting out on a highly competitive level, what's going to give you the edge isn't necessarily your meta read. It's going to be the ability to understand your deck and be able to, when you are exhausted and, you know, you're on that bubble game, you know, you're either going to go 5-1 or 4-2, and that could decide if you're going to make the cut. The ability that, you know, when it's just you, your Red Bull, and the deck, that you're going to be able to remember what those plays are and what your deck is trying to do, which you may not be able to do with sort of the hottest version of Landy Dragon that you pulled off that morning from ThronesDB.
Yeah. I think that is really some best advice there. And in general, that is what I come back to and make my final decision on with most decks. But to kind of give folks a more, I guess, kind of numerical example of what we're talking about here, it's basically just kind of like, what is the efficiency that you can squeeze out of that deck in your play and performance. So sure, you know, we're going to talk some round numbers here to make it easy. Sure, you may be tempted to go net deck that sweet new deck that you know, took down Spanish championships or something like that off of ThronesDB. And for round numbers' sake, let's say that deck has 100 in just straight up power or strength potential, right? But it's new to you. You're not familiar with all the interactions, even though you're familiar with most of the cards. You know, maybe you only get, let's say, 70% of real strength out of it because you're not familiar, right? Versus the deck that, as Roy said, you've got all those reps in. Well, yeah, maybe it's not that perfect meta call, as he said. Maybe, you know, viewed in kind of a vacuum of power levels, maybe it's only an 85 compared to the 100 of the hot new deck. But you've got the reps and you can squeeze out all of those important interactions and get 100% efficiency out of it. Well, now you're at 85, higher than the middling kind of efficiency you're able to squeeze out of something that you're not familiar with.
Absolutely. Thrones, unlike I think some other card games, even in sort of middle level play, not like the top level play, but even middle level play that most people, you know, who are first coming to their first event play at, you know, small decisions actually matter a lot more. There's a lot of weird interactions in Thrones, right? And there's a lot of triggers to forget. There's a lot to keep track of in the board state with Thrones. And if you have never done the Worlds or the Gen Con or even larger 40 or 50 person tournament experiences, being able to just know in the back of your brain that, you know, you have Plaza and Punishment in your deck and your deck is trying to do this with that, instead of, you know, oh, Oh, and, you know, you never want to draw a card and be like, oh, what is this deck supposed to, what is this supposed to do in this deck that you might do with a net deck that you, again, just pulled off that morning or maybe even only a week ago. So just keeping the margin from error, the margin for error as small as possible with your own play is really key to the first time that you begin, your tournament experience. And the best way to do that, again, is to pick a deck you're comfortable with, that has a play style you're comfortable with. Like, you can't expect yourself, if this is the beginning of your competitive career, to be the master of everything like someone like Greg or, you know, Bruno or Darknaj are. You know, you've got to be able to, you know, master what the kind of style you are comfortable with, and then gain more and more confidence in your broader throne skill set that will come in later tournaments.
Okay, so moving to the next step then, you know, even though you probably have some reps here, I think most folks that I know, before they go into one of these larger tournaments, spend some time in the weeks or month before kind of grinding out games, as the saying goes, trying to play a lot of games fairly quickly. I'm sure you guys probably have tackled that in your meta, Roy. I know it's pretty active up there. How do you guys tackle that process?
Well, we do it in a very systematic process, right? Where people suggest decks. We have the great benefit of having three or four, when Dave's active, of the best deck builders in the world, in our meta. So, you know, people make suggestions, but anyone can make suggestions, and we look at the results that tournaments both in North America and Europe and the rest of the world are doing. And then Dan builds those decks with either proxies or his own collection, and then we play. We play both on Octagon, we play at our normal meetup dimes, but we also, you know, before Gen Con every year, we have a testing weekend where our entire build group, to the best of our ability, gets together and knocks out as many games as possible. And we move people around. We try to make sure that, you know, our best players are playing, you know, like Darknaj is playing with someone like me. So a great player and someone who's sort of more middle tier player, right? To sort of get a mixture of different play styles and a mixture of different player levels so that, you know, just because John is able to own everybody with this deck doesn't necessarily mean it's the best deck. We need to be able to see when people further down the skill level if they're able to have similar results. And, you know, it all goes down on a sheet of paper. It all gets written down. And then once over the process of the weekend, we have meetings where we talk about, you know, oh, what is, you know, Landy Dragon? How is that doing? Okay, Landy Dragon is really good. Oh, Lannister No Agenda. We thought that would be really cool going in because it won this tournament. Night's Watch. Oh, you know, Aaron was really pushing this Night's Watch build, but it didn't work out. Martel Lion, we have a good build of it, but maybe if we tweak these cards, it will improve in testing. So we go through and give a lot of feedback. It's very, very systematic when we're preparing for tournaments like Gen Con or Worlds.
Yeah. I mean, I think that sounds very awesome and systematic. And I think you definitely have an advantage with the strong folks that are in your neighborhood. I think I've definitely had that advantage as well here in the Midwest. You know, as much as we mentioned his name here, having Greg available to me, we've maybe not had quite the breadth of different options and opponents as our meta has, you know, waxed and waned over the years, but he's always been a good resource. We generally do similarly as far as building a handful of different decks, and how we've kind of handled some of that is the person, like one person would generally be the one like kind of wanting to run a deck through the fire, so to speak, right? So say it's me. I'll sit down with my deck, play maybe three or four games in a row against completely different decks, but all using the same one on my side. And then maybe flip in the end. Because, of course, some of the balance here is if several of you are going, you don't necessarily, like, you need the different experience against the different decks, but also if you're going, you need the reps with your own deck. So I think kind of working out how to handle that transition and to make sure that people are getting not only reps with the deck that they are most likely to play and wanting to kind of narrow down, but also getting to let the other opponents that are cycling through stuff to do the same. And I mean, on the flip side, when you're the one cycling decks, I really feel like you're still getting valuable knowledge about how other decks work and what their weak points are that can be utilized later when you are playing the deck.
Oh, absolutely. That's definitely the case. You know, when you're practicing with someone, that you definitely need to, when you're in practice mode, you definitely need to take the games very seriously, even if you're not the person who is sort of in the hot seat, right? Whose deck is supposed to be running through the paces, right? You should view what the games you're playing as just as useful. You know, that's a trap I sometimes find myself running into is like, we're paying so much attention to, say, how Will's, you know, Tyrell Sun deck is running, and we'll be talking about, oh, is this the right plot, you know, as the game is progressing, instead of me necessarily also focusing on the fact that, you know, I'm playing Landy Dragon, and I need to be able to see, well, what's Landy Dragon doing? Because even if I don't end up playing the deck that Will's testing, or Will doesn't end up playing, we're learning something about how Landy Dragon operates. And that's really important to keep in mind, that it's sort of a two-way relationship with testing. The other thing I would add here is sort of in the abstract level, if you're not lucky enough to be in one of the bigger areas like New York or Springfield or Chicago, or of course our friends in SoCal, you know, don't be afraid to go online and ask people. Like, this is the number one thing that I think sometimes people don't really get, is that people that are on these podcasts, from Aaron to myself or Will or John or, you know, Alex, they are, or Sid, or, you know, even Buzz. Buzz might seem grumpy sometimes, but he's definitely really nice. You know, if you message them and say, hey, I'm interested in, you know, this deck, you know, what do you think? You know, I've put a lot of practice into this deck. Would you take a look at this deck list? And they'll often make suggestions, and they'll be more than willing to help, and maybe more than willing to guide you in certain directions. And don't be afraid to go on Discord or CardGameDB or the Skype group, which sort of is intermittently, you know, active, to sort of look for practice partners, because you'll often find people, particularly in that, you know, maybe 2 months out from a big event, who are ready to do reps with you, even if they're, you know, in Sweden and you're in Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah, no, I think that is great. And talking to these different people and getting insight from outside your own area is incredibly valuable, even if you are in these more active kind of hotspots that Roy mentioned, because even then they can still kind of tend to be insular and develop the kind of a localized meta. And if you're looking at attending something that you have to travel for, say, World Championship weekend or whatnot, you're going to run into folks from outside that are utilizing different tech and ideas and things that they've experimented with in the game. So reaching out to other folks helps you keep a little bit more of a pulse on that. Now, granted, I do know some groups who historically have viewed kind of the opposite of that and become very insular in their testing and talking to other groups and don't want to give away any tech or edge. And I think knowing just kind of the different folks that generally seem to consistently put up the big and respectable wins, I think it's been more common over the years that the folks that do interact and discuss with others and get that kind of feedback and insight from other places do tend to do better overall Am I crazy in that observation, Roy, or would you agree?
This is a little off topic. This is from what we're talking about. But I mean, I think that's probably one of the more controversial questions in sort of the meta of the Thrones, global meta, right, is whether or not the openness policy of discussing decks, which you might call, you know, like the podcast policy, right? Because to various degrees, all of the various different podcasts talk about tech, talk about decks constantly. And then the sort of the DC perspective, which is very close-knit, very, you know, their decks are their decks are their decks. They will share them only with their build group or maybe like an allied build group, right, with the Wisconsin guys. So DC, Wisconsin has their own little world that is 100% only their world. You know, there have been people from the more open community who have done incredibly well and are world champions in the past. And of course, DC, Wisconsin has plenty of people. So I think it's definitely a mixed approach, and we have talked about it a lot. I'm going to plug the Second Sons for a second, but there's several Second Sons episodes that we've gone into detail with members of both sort of more open-minded players who are wanting to share, and sort of we've had Seth on, right? And Seth is sort of the public, for better or for worse, the public face of that point of view. And you can sort of check the sort of debate and different perspectives we've had about that in those episodes.
Okay, so we'll move on to another semi-controversial issue, but I don't think one that I've heard really discussed on podcasts. In fact, I don't even really remember discussing it here, though I definitely know it's something I've discussed locally before. And I'm still not convinced that I've come down 100% one way or the other. So let me fill you and the listeners in on the scenario here then. So say that you are walking through these testing sessions. Doesn't matter whether you are the hot seat, as Roy put it, the one whose deck is being put through the paces, or if you are the field or whatever you may want to call it, that is running a variety of decks against them. But when you get to a certain point in a game where it looks hopeless, do you go ahead and scoop and move on to a new game? It's a tricky one. I think I've done both sometimes. I've made the kind of mental argument before that, you know what, I've played variations on these games before. I can see points A, B, C, corollary E, and, you know, letter Q way down at the end point. I know, not Z. I was as surprised as you. And I know how this is going to play out. It's not worth it. I don't learn anything. But we can get more games in and see if there's an early enough weak point to break whatever that point is, that point of no return, if I go ahead and scoop. On the other hand, I've made the argument that, you know, you're going to get into these positions in games at the tournament. And who knows, eventually you might draw something or think of a plan that can break that later on. I'm torn. I'm maybe 60-40 at the moment in favor of scooping. I do feel the longer that kind of lock goes, especially the way second edition is right now, I think the less likely you are to break out of the point of no return. How about you, Roy?
I'm 100% on Team Scoop. I mean, there's a nuanced version of this, which I'll get to. But I think when you're testing, particularly early on, the primary point is to sort of see how get as many reps in as possible and see how matchups are going to work out over multiple games. And you know what? We don't have, unless, you know, you're, the longer you know, the best way to put this is I don't have the time to play, you know, Thrones for 8 hours in one day or 6 hours in one day. So I have like maybe an hour to maybe 4 hours if it's a really lucky play day. You know, I want to get as many games in as possible in that 4 hour period, particularly when you're crunching for a big tournament like Gen Con. And some, you know, if you try to play a tournament length game, that's four tournament length games that you're going to get in. And four games is a piss poor sample size, you know, and four games over, you know, only 4 weeks or, you know, so that's, you know, 16 games over 4 weeks or whatever, or eight games, you know, is not enough, right? You want to get lots and lots of games, and particularly if you're trying to run it through multiple matchups. So I generally think if you are seriously trying to testing, scooping, if it's clear who's going to win after the second or third plot is the best way to go about it. Even if there was a, say, 20% chance that player B could have pulled it out from player A. Now, the closer you get to the actual day of the tournament, I believe you should play games up to the end. Because, you know, getting those reps in, of finding those corner cases, finding those, you know, outs, and learning how to play to your outs is a huge skill. But it's definitely one that comes to the end of the process, not at the beginning. And my main disagreement with a lot of people with testing is, and I'm definitely a scooper, I'm like, oh, okay, it's clear you're going to win, let's scoop, let's play again. There's is that drive, the reason we all get into this, particularly if we come primarily from casual board game, is to just win in any context, right? Casual game, I want to win. Tournament game, I want to win. But testing isn't about winning. Testing is about gaining knowledge. And that's what you sort of need to separate from the sort of individual satisfaction you might gain from separate the individual satisfaction you get from games from the much larger satisfaction you will get from doing well in the tournament. And I would gladly sacrifice that individual satisfaction of kicking, you know, my friend George's ass, in this, you know, our testing games if it means that I can make the cut at Gen Con.
Yeah, no, I think that is a pretty fantastic way to look at it. And I think that's something that's hard for a lot of players to do, is to kind of separate that that urge to win out into a couple different levels, from that personal to the tournament win, as you were saying. So, yeah, I think that's really important for folks to be looking at.
Yeah, in my own play, once I started doing that, I saw my own play go up, my own skill level go up, my own success rate go up. So it's definitely speaking from personal experience that sort of once when I got into this sort of playtesting mode, that I definitely saw myself become a better player.
Well, grinding down or zooming in a little bit further in on some of the playtesting mechanics, I wanted to bring something up. Longtime listeners will have already heard this before, but there may be some newbies out there that have not heard us talk about this before. And it's something that I've found very useful over the years that Greg turned me on to, because the plot game is so important in Game of Thrones. Now, yeah, you could argue specific plot game has kind of loosened up a little bit in second edition in favor of just making sure you have money and then going from there. But still, I do feel it's important, and I do feel this tool is useful. And what that is when we've been testing before down here in Missouri, especially when you feel really pretty confident in the draw deck that you're playing, and you know the way it's shuffled and randomized, changing one or two cards out, and it has much less of an impact versus how you change up your plots, right? You want to be very certain of the seven plots that you take to a tournament setting, that they are the best possible options for you, because you only have those seven, and you get to be certain of which ones you have available at any given time. So what we would do then is go ahead and reveal plots and then determine, okay, I don't care what the printed card in here is. It could be Wildfire Assault. It could be whatever. But I'm going to go ahead and declare that right now, this turn, that plot is Noble Cause or Calm Over Westeros or whatever it may be. Kind of a mental thrones, right? It's an exercise in determining which plots are most useful for you. And keep a little scratch pad by you, jot down the name of a plot, maybe a little tick mark next to the plots that you feel are the best for you in that situation the most times. And then you can, you know, once you've ran through a significant number of reps there, you can kind of take stock of those plots that have been the most frequent choices and say, okay, I really feel like these are going to be my strongest options going forward.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good way of early on testing with decks. It's something that definitely I've done when sort of moving, beginning the transition deck from the conceptual level into sort of a practical deck that you might consider taking to a tournament. You know, of course, just like with my suggestion that, you know, you start playing out longer and longer games, the closer and closer you get to the tournament, the closer and closer you get to the tournament, you should begin to, like, lock your plot deck, at least a little bit. Obviously, you should make changes if you feel there's a fundamental difference. And, you know, many people have won big tournaments, you know, when they changed one plot at the last second, right? They crossed something off on their deck list and wrote something out. But generally speaking, you know, you should begin to lock 5 of your 7 plots, you know, a couple weeks out and begin to think of, all right, I'm limited by these plot choices. How can I play my outs? Because that's also a skill, right? Of also figuring out, well, this plot, you know, I have 3 plots left and they're not optimal for this situation, but how can I make the best out of them? So sort of once you've gone through those steps that Will described, you need to start thinking about, okay, I'm going to be locked in this set of plots. How, if I get in a matchup where none of these plots are particularly optimal, am I going to be able to play out of that matchup?
Yeah, well then, you know, what other tips and tricks in tourney preparation do we have here?
Well,
I feel like so many of mine kind of come up on a case-by-case basis. What were you thinking there, Roy?
Well, I was thinking probably one of the more controversial questions, Will, should you play a tournament hungover?
That's funny.
I am generally opposed to it. You know, particularly if you have to drive a good distance, if it's like a one-day big tournament, like you're driving to a regional, this is because I hate driving hungover. This might just be a personal thing, but I hate driving hungover. I just hate it. So I tend not to want to be hungover, for, a tournament. That said, being hungover for Melee is apparently a pretty good thing to do, because fuck was I hungover at the Gen Con Melee this year, and I made the top 16. And the previous at Worlds, when I went 3-2-2, I was also really hungover, and my friend saved me by giving me half a 5-hour energy because I was so fucking hungover. So, you know, 50-50 for me there, I guess, or 60-40. Like, most of the time, I don't think you should be hungover, but there was those edge cases, particularly when you're at these, like, big events like Gen Con and Worlds where, you know, everyone's going to want to party every night. It's going to be hard to not be hungover. What do you think, Will, of this very controversial question?
You know, that's a tough one, especially once you start throwing in examples. Like, I want to say it's a bad idea to be hungover, you know, especially sometimes when you get in these big groups and really party, you can go so far that, like, Kristen has had to miss a tournament before because she was so hungover at Gen Con. I've been in a state that was, let's say, incredibly unpleasant for the ride back home, thankfully. There was not a tournament that day. You know, but then on the other hand, you look at people like Ryan Jones, who, if I remember correctly, at the 2 final Melee tables he made it to, was just astoundingly, like, head-poundingly hungover from partying the night before. Was he not?
I think so. I think Ryan, like, slept at Worlds last year, like, 3 hours each night. I'm sure Ryan can correct us in the comments somewhere if he listens to this. But, yeah, he was, like, because Ryan was a beast that weekend last year. He was, like, playing until 3 o'clock in the morning, drinking until Joe Stenzer's closed maybe a couple hours later, and then, boom, up for the start of the next day at 8 or 9 o'clock. So, like, yeah, if you're... But when it comes to Thrones, Ryan probably knows more than what you can combine Will and I together, right? He's that kind of amazing person at the game. Not all of us can you know, play at Ryan's level even completely sober. So you might not want to base your choices on what Ryan does with that case.
Yeah. I think overall I would highly recommend that you be amply hydrated and have a proper amount of sleep. But do make sure that you take some time to relax in the evenings. particularly at these multi-day events, Gen Con and Worlds and such. Don't go overboard, but do make sure that you're out and having fun and having a good time. I really think that if you spend too much time stressing in between and whatnot, that it's going to hamper your abilities. Be attentive, but not too tense, too wired.
Absolutely. And it's good that Will mentioned hydrated. Like, you should, my suggestion is always, and this is something I did my first year at Gen Con, but did not do last year, which is like bring snacks, like go and buy, go to Walmart or Target or whatever and buy like a case of like those Nature's Promise bars or Clif bars or whatever, bar you can think of that, when you get hungry and,
just not Nature Valley. They're too dry. You're going to need double the water.
Yeah. And a big bottle of water. And, I personally like 5-hour energy for tournaments, but, Red Bull is also pretty good. Like ways to sort of like push, help push you through to that next level. Cause there's going to reach a point where you hit a wall, particularly if you're playing at Worlds or Gen Con, from 9 a.m. to 5 or 6 p.m. of many different rounds. You're going to want to make sure that, you might not have time for lunch. If your game goes right to time right before lunch, you may not have as much time, particularly at a place like Gen Con. Worlds, they at least have the food, although that fucking line at the convention center for food is sometimes worse than the Gen Con lines. So, there may not be the time you want to get as much food as you want. So having snacks available to you that you can just maybe even munch on while a game is going on. If it's something that's not messy, like a bar, right? You can do that. And so keeping hydrated and making sure your caffeine levels, if you're a caffeine drinker, are high enough, that's going to really help your overall experience. And you will never regret having like that couple of Clif bars in your backpack or your bag to pull out, after round 4.
Yeah. I agree with that completely. And I would throw in a slight added tip that I've, heard Magic players recommend almonds as increasing brain function. So be on the lookout. Maybe it pays off for them. Maybe it doesn't. But it might be worth a shot.
Yeah, maybe I'll try that next year at Worlds, or I'll try it at Red Saturday. That's the next big thing I'm coming to. Almonds are great.
Yeah, perfect.
Any other general stuff, Will, that I can think of?
Yeah.
Text your partner, girlfriend, boyfriend before, in between rounds, send the, hey, the first round starting, I won't be able to necessarily, reply for another hour or so. That saves you, your phone going off the whole round and things like that. That's always a good idea.
Yeah. That is very important. I can speak from personal experience. Don't let yourself, have a good time, but don't let yourself become so wrapped up in things that you don't acknowledge your significant other for 6 hours or something, they will not be happy.
What else? Oh, make sure, double check your deck list. That's another thing. I personally, I'm a little less cautious than I used to be, but when I was first starting going to these big tournaments, I would do my deck list in advance. And I know that goes against some people's opinions of, you need to be able to change that 2 cards right before, you submit your deck list. And if you have a pre-printed deck list, that's impossible. But I generally think to save yourself a bit of a headache, particularly if you're traveling that day to the event, you could run into traffic, something happened to your car, you desperately needed breakfast on the way or whatever, not having to rush that last couple of seconds to turn your deck list in, or, to make sure, to give you an extra chance to double check your deck list to make sure, you have enough cards to reach the non-loyal card limit of your banner agenda, or, you're under that limit for the fealty agenda, what have you, giving yourself that extra time by having a pre-prepared deck list is really nice.
Yeah, and as a kind of a corollary to that, I would say even if you're rushing there and planning on writing your deck list there or making some last minute tweaks or something, I don't think it's a bad idea to keep a handful, 2 or 3 extra cards that were kind of on the fence in your deck box with you, and a couple extra sleeves as well. if you're making those last minute changes and tweaks and stuff whenever you go to write your deck list, you know, definitely walk through it, count it, give it a check. Don't wind up like anybody at our regional this year. And if you have a couple extra cards in your box, you've got some leeway and you can fix things. If you go to make that last minute count, you realize, oh, holy crap, I am playing 59 cards in my deck or something like that. And of course, sleeves, you know, we're shuffling and fiddling with cards all day, this, that, and the other. And they can rip, they can tear, things can happen. And I've seen people before have to, you know, get up and go buy two new sets of sleeves in, you know, the middle of a tournament because they had two cards rip out of their sleeves or something and they had no replacements or anything. And of course, they can't play with unsleeved cards or only 58 cards in the deck. So plan ahead.
Absolutely. I second tripled whatever the extra sleeves. Like, I have a deck box that's sort of just spare sleeves. It's also where I stick sort of my alt art cards when I get them so I don't lose them, that I sort of carry with me to every tournament that's got sort of spare sleeves for both my plot deck and my draw deck, so that when something bad happens, and almost certainly I rip maybe one to two sleeves every tournament, you know, because it's just not just the wear of the games that day, but the wear of all of the games on those sleeves up to that point, right? So you just be ready, and it will just sort of save you that headache as well.
Yeah, sure enough.
Spare tokens as well.
I think that is a good idea. We've had the nightmare story experience there. My good friend Justin, who used to play the game, playing against Greg in a regional championship during the CCG. He was using, you know, some sweet custom tokens. Actually, they were FFG official at the time. But regardless, they didn't quite fit on the house card, you know, as most folks line them up in rows of three and so on. He could only fit 12 on the house card, and so then he would generally set another line of three behind the house card as he went. But he was using another FFG prize house card that was, you know, quarter inch or a little more thick, one of the marble house cards back in the day. And well, here I am realizing in the middle of this that I'm conflating stories. This one was where Greg couldn't see that over the house card, see the back row of tokens. But later on, with the exact same deck, Justin won a number of local games with 14 power counters because we had not realized that he had lost one. So it really pays to count your opponent's tokens wherever they are, be they on or behind house cards or strung out over characters. Make sure you count your opponent's tokens and don't just take it for granted that they won.
Yeah, or do the really embarrassing thing where you've misplaced two tokens and you think, oh man, you go into your box for that last power token and you're like, oh, I win. No, you only have 13 power. That's... And then your opponent's like, no, you only have 13 power, and your just heart breaks just a little bit. So,
yeah, especially if you maybe overcommitted to a challenge to get the renown or something.
Yeah, totally has never happened to me. If you could see me shaking my head, yes, I have done this.
Well, I think overall we've covered a span of kind of testing options and kind of tourney day. Fail safes. I think we've covered about everything I can think of at the moment. Props and slops.
I want to slop moving because it sucks a lot.
Oh, that is worth it. It's terrible. So you're still kind of mid move, right?
Yeah. Well, because I am, as the joke I've been making is I'm paying cat rent this month. So I'm in Philadelphia working with my new job and living with my girlfriend, Ella, and I'm trying to find because her apartment doesn't take cats, so I have to find another apartment that will take cats, and that's what I'm in the process of doing. So most of my stuff is in New York, including most of my Thrones cards, and my cats are in New York, but my physical presence and my clothing is here in Philadelphia. So it's kind of chaotic. Super chaotic.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds like a mess. And then once you find it, unpack and whatnot. Ugh. How are the cats doing, by the way? I believe one of them had some issues.
Yeah, and apparently, according to my roommates, he's having a little bit of issues again. So we'll see if that means he has to go back to the vet. That's like a whole another headache of stuff that is difficult to deal with when you're in a totally different city. So lots of stuff going on in my always chaotic personal life. But yeah, the core slop there is moving, which is the worst.
Well, I'm going to give some slops to animal issues myself, as our cat has had some issues, seems to have gotten a few fleas and maybe had an allergic reaction to some food and whatnot. And, you know, it is not fun trying to force feed your animal medicine. And then they hate you for at least the rest of the night. Yeah, just a bummer.
Yeah, sick animals is, you know, not very fun. I will be honest. I love my animals and would never get rid of them. But when they get sick, it's heartbreaking and wallet breaking at the same time.
Oof. Yeah. Yeah. Not fun. Well, speaking of wallet breaking, I think I have a slop, but it's a step removed from how this starts. So one of our buddies, Mike, that we play RPGs with, has been a subscriber to Blue Apron for maybe a month now. And of course, you know, that's free torque trials and things that you can give out. And so we took him up on that so we could give it a whirl. And, you know, I doubted at $60 a week that we were going to stick with it. But I was willing to take a week of free food, right? And, you know, it's interesting. It's not bad. The first meal, honestly, was pretty good. Surprised me with actually being pretty tasty colored greens. But the second meal was kind of bizarre and not that great. So I'm going to slop coleslaw.
Coleslaw's gross.
Yeah, it wasn't actively like terrible or gross, but it's just not good. Even made fresh, it's just not very good. So there you go. Slops to coleslaw.
Well, I have a prop, which I may have mentioned last time that I was on, but I can't remember. It may have been something we were talking about in Second Sons. But anyway, my prop is one of the advantages of having a sick cat is that you're waiting with surgery is that you get to sit and watch a lot of Netflix. And I watched in one day basically all of Luke Cage, and then the following day I watched the rest. And it's really good. So if you like superhero shows, superhero fiction, you should watch Luke Cage. It suffers from a couple of the problems that the Marvel shows in general do, which is, you know, it's like maybe a couple episodes too long. But overall, and this like the final like super villain isn't that great, but overall the show is fantastic. It's really well casted, really well acted. The sort of first seven episodes are utterly fantastic, and then like the last two are also really fantastic, with the ones in between being a little, say, middle of the road. I'd say it's probably more consistently good than Daredevil season two, which I still liked a lot, but it was definitely probably the weakest of the Marvel shows. But it's certainly up there with the first season of Daredevil, up there with Jessica Jones. So if you've liked what Netflix has had to offer, you should definitely watch Luke Cage.
Kristen and I still need to get to that. Too many things right now coming out or starting back up to really get rolling on. And that, I think, leads to my prop, which is going to be to the season premiere of Supergirl. I already had a lot of fun with the first season, and I really, really enjoyed it. I was excited that it got to keep going with the switch to CW. And I like Supergirl as a character. I like this portrayal. I like the show. I don't by any means want Superman to usurp her, but I was, you know, excited that they were going to get the okay to use him on television. I was skeptical of the casting, and then some of the still shots we saw of Tyler Hoechlin were not great. But then I watched the episode, and it was so good. It's still a campy superhero show, but it's one of the best episodes of just fun, like lighthearted, spirited, inspiring superhero show that I have watched. Supergirl herself remains awesome. I look forward to that. Their interactions were great, but it was fantastic seeing them just nail Clark Kent and Superman, especially coming later this year after the dismal failure of an interpretation that was Batman versus Superman. It was just so refreshing to see someone nail that so well.
I'm looking forward to it. I guess if we're in the CW world, I want to slop mostly the Flash season premiere, which adapts probably my least favorite DC comic story of all time, which is...
Adapt is generous, even.
Yeah.
It was not what I was expecting.
Yeah, well, I'm glad. I mean, the best thing that could be said about... Well, I don't want to be too spoilerific, so I won't, but...
It's still early.
It's still, yeah. Anyway, I have a whole spoiler-filled rant that I would like to go on about this, but I won't. But I would just say, in general, I found it to be really weak, particularly compared to, I think, you know, the Flash pilot was really solid and the season premiere last year was really solid. I'm not as excited for the Flash season as I want to be, because I really love the cast of that show. And I think actually in general, all of the CW superhero shows, even Legends of Tomorrow, which is probably the weakest of them, although I haven't really liked the last three or four seasons of Arrow, have really strong casts. The writing isn't always good, the action staging isn't always the best, but the casts are really good and they're really charming and they have great chemistry. But the Flash season premiere didn't really take advantage of any of that. It just sort of, well, it did things that make you want to not cheer for Barry. And why do I want to spend 22 to 24 hours a year not wanting to cheer for my main character? This is not The Sopranos. This is not House of Cards. This is not whatever. It's a superhero show. You should want to cheer for the protagonist. And what the choices that they made with Barry over the last second half of the second season and into now the third just makes him just a face palm of a character. And I found myself frustrated at the end of the episode.
Even really just the season finale of last year, I'm still not.
Can we spoil the season finale? Because it was so dumb.
Okay. All right. Tell you what. Spoiler alert, listeners. If you're just now getting around to watching last season on Netflix, tune out for a moment.
Go to the danger zone.
Yeah. Go ahead and go to the danger zone. The rest of us will be here later.
Yeah. So anyway, the what happens, right, is Barry, like, it makes no sense, right? The emotional moment at the end of the season is Barry comes to peace with the fact that his parents are dead. And then...
Well, on the penultimate episode.
Right, penultimate episode. Well, and also in...
It's a big deal. Yeah, it's a big deal.
Well, but also into the finale, right? When he defeats Zoom and then Joe gives him that whole, like, we're family, it's going to be okay. And Barry smiles and you're like, oh, the season's over. And no. They have this really bad twist at the end.
I thought you were going to spoil it.
Where he goes back in time and saves his mom, which is the worst thing ever.
And thus also his dad.
Yes.
But Yeah, it was so terrible, and I think made all the worse by having him resolve those issues literally like moments before, or like in series time, like the day before. He's like, "Okay, guys, yeah, I think I've dealt with this. I'm good. Nah." It felt pretty forced, even for CW.
Yeah, and I think Flash, even more than Legends of Tomorrow, which builds time travel into its entire premise, Flash proves that time travel is a plot concept that can easily overstay its welcome, and I feel like it definitely has on The Flash. And I hope that the third season gets away from that and just sort of moves forward with other Barry storylines and other things that being really, really fast can accomplish for you.
Yeah, I hope they do too. Like you mentioned before about the cast being great and charming and wanting to cheer for a hero. Like when the Flash is kind of firing on all cylinders, I think they do that the best of any of the superhero TV shows, Marvel or DC. Like Barry is just so damn charming, and like you just feel inspired, and you're like, yes, this is the way it's supposed to be. And that makes it all the weirder when they shoot themselves or shoot Barry in the foot like that. So it's just odd.
Yeah. I did actually like the Arrow premiere this year.
I still have not watched that. May need to watch that with Kristen after this.
Well, and I need to go to bed soon. So is there any final props or slots?
No. I think we can safely and officially move ourselves the danger zone. You know what that does, Roy?
Does it something about a chapter?
Yeah. Of the White Book.
Closing. Close. Yes.
Yeah.
Close.
Right. Awesome.